This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at KABF.org, WAMF.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available to the show on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Professor Pavan Dhingra, who is a professor at Amherst College in Massachusetts and has written a book called Hyper-Education, Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. Welcome to Wade's World, Professor.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and you know, the headlines are full of stories about education. So for us to talk about hyper-education, I mean, it's almost hyper-education to say kids can go back to school, isn't it?
That's right. That feels like a major accomplishment or challenge right now, right?
It used to be just getting them up in the morning was the big thing. Now it's actually getting them out of the house for many parents. I watched a neighbor with her three children outside on the steps of their porch with what clearly was a visiting tutor. And I thought about you yesterday. Who knows what they were doing? Professor, give us the bottom line on hyper-education and why you decided to write this book.
Well, there's a growing trend in our country right now of families who are, you know, in fine school districts, but who are saying, you know what, I want my kids to get even more education than what they're getting in their second grade or fifth grade, and they're seeking supplemental education outside of school. That can take many forms. It could be, you know, a local Kumon or Mathnasium, and I know you're broadcast all over the world, but it's in New Orleans, right? There's Kumon, Mathnasium in New Orleans, and Gretna, and West Bank, and everywhere else, right, across the country. And those are just examples, some examples of spaces people are turning to that are becoming some of the fastest growing companies in the country because more and more parents are saying the school is not doing enough for me. No matter what kind of school you're in, whether it's under-resourced or incredibly highly ranked, that's what parents are feeling. And the result then is a widening educational gap between those who are able to get access to these resources and those who aren't. And teachers are worried about this. Kids feel stressed out. Parents are putting their money and time into this. And we have to understand what's motivating this and what are the consequences of this new normal in education.
And, of course, there's huge irony because many of the school districts you studied, particularly in the suburbs of Boston and even in the area around where Amherst is, Northampton, et cetera, these are reputedly some of the best schools in the country.
This is a trend that's surprisingly, right, to your point. Parents don't need to be in problematic or school districts that have been receiving warnings to feel to be worried about their kids' academic success or academic growth. This is taking place across the country, in, you know, whether it be in New Jersey, whether it be in Louisiana or Texas, where I grew up, and all over the country. This is a growing trend. In fact, I spoke to directors of some tutoring companies. And their growth model is to create new locations primarily in areas that already have, you know, highly successful school districts. That's where they're targeting their growth, not in areas where students would actually probably need more academic support because the schools aren't providing it for some reason.
And, of course, you know, three of the stations that are going to be broadcasting the show are in historically bad school districts where they're in highly contentious fights with states taking over the systems and everything else, Little Rock, New Orleans. I don't even want to tell you about Greenville. So, I mean, it's, you know, we need basic education. But part of the argument that fascinated me is that this critique also comes from the expansive growth of neoliberalism as a way of looking at all these questions in your book.
Right. That's, you know, really well put. I mean, the parents are more and more, this is true across economic lines, across racial lines, geographic lines, parents are being expected to, you know, instill and be responsible for all the growth for their kids. If your kid doesn't do well in school, if your kid doesn't get an internship or a job, then that's somehow on you. And the government's not there to support it as much as it used to be. The community's not there to support it as much as it used to be. And so parents feel burdened, in fact, stressed out and worried. Is my kid going to do well? Am I doing enough? And so parents are putting their kids, spending the money, putting their kids in online opportunities or in-person opportunities as a result. And that's what we're seeing across even our school system. You're talking about, you know, school systems that are fighting against the state, right? And they've been underfunded for so many years. This is not by accident, right? That's often, you know, whether it's either intentional, it's not something that people have been, you know, trying to fix for long enough. And as a result, you're finding greater inequalities across school districts. And parents, whether they're in good schools or under-resourced schools, feel it's our responsibility to take care of our kids, because you can't trust the government to be looking out for you.
And this is particularly epidemic in public schools and the critique of those schools. I mean, certainly you mentioned being from Texas. I mean, the fight for equalization of funding in Texas independent school districts has been going how many decades now?
Yeah, right. No, that's true. And so one of the things that when we talk about the privatization of schools and the attack on the public schools, right, we think about it in terms of charter schools or government takeovers or the like. But when families who are in public schools are saying, you know what, I don't trust my school, even if it's doing well, provide an education for my kid, and they go out and pay for extra lessons at a local private learning center. In a sense, what they're saying is, I want the private marketplace to educate my kid because the school somehow is insufficient. And that's another way in which the public school is under attack by the private marketplace. And a lot of these companies, which are fine companies, I don't have a problem with any of these companies, but a lot of these companies have grown because of the broader critique of public schooling in the sense that we can't trust it, and all the rhetoric by politicians and pundits that our teachers don't know what they're doing. This creates a climate where parents are fearful, right? And they're going to seek opportunities outside of the public school, thereby kind of encroaching on the legitimacy of our public schools at a time when we need to support them even more.
And we have an issue. I mean, certainly the publicity in the New York City school system, and we have a school here in New Orleans. Benjamin Franklin has always been critiqued since the 60s when it founded. That's a magnet school that used to have selective requirements on IQ and achievement tests. But this sort of magnetizing creates another level of inequality in the school system that must be driving some of the hyper-pressure as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. We have tracking in schools, which is a necessary evil, some parents say. We have different schools for different kind of level cognitive abilities, right? All we're doing, right, is saying, you know, kids at a very young age, we need to separate you. We need to decide who's going to be our and who's going to be the supporting cast. And that, but then we have kind of created self-fulfilling prophecies as a result, right? And parents want, you know, what they call a differentiated learning. They want to know that if their kid shows aptitude in something, the child will be challenged in the school. So that makes sense. That's fair, right? But we've created a system where we say, you know, which is oftentimes kind of racially coded and class marked, to say these are the ones we're going to put our resources into. These are the kids we're going to let go, you know, stay in the general population or such. And that's a real problem that reproduces the kinds of inequality that schools are actually meant to fix.
Right? Exactly. That's the whole point of public education. And I don't want to get onto one of my private personal peeves, which is this sort of false theme of meritocracy that comes out of these schools.
Right.
you know, as if somehow if you put somebody in a special track in a magnet school, the meritocracy will prevail. Well, I don't know what country that is, but it's not the United States. So like I say, I'm going to keep off of my private thing. This is about you, Professor. We're talking to Professor Pavan Dhingra, who's a professor at Amherst College. He's written a book called Hypereducation, Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. You also pull very powerfully on the themes of how racial attitudes are embedded in this question as well.
Yeah, so a lot of the thank you for bringing that up. So a lot of the families I spoke to are immigrant families, and they encounter a lot of tensions with their schools if they're seen to be, you know, ironically, educating their kids too much. So, right, you know, we would imagine, right, that if kids are getting really academically, the teachers and principals would be really proud of them and they would be really applauding them. But in fact, you find that when immigrant kids of color kind of outperform white in schools, that instead of applauding them, a lot of principals and teachers were, you know, say they're pushing too, the parents are pushing too hard, they're exaggerating how much academics matters, kids need to relax more. In other words, right, there's a sense where if the white students are feeling pressured and not feeling like they're on top, right,
They want to dial down the competition.
Dial down, well put. Yeah, dial down the competition. And I see a lot of that. I want to stress this is coming from very well-meaning teachers, very thoughtful principals. So they're on to something. My stress matters. Pressure and anxiety create bad mental health outcomes, and that is very real. But it still gets coded racially as these are problematic parents who need to adjust to our ways of being, that is the kind of the general middle-class white model, and that would solve all of these problems. And it shows a lack of self-awareness, right? And so see this way in which immigrant families, and not just immigrants, but other people of color, are oftentimes framed as problems because they don't fit into the standard model of the schools. That happens, you know, whether you're black or brown, whether you're Asian, whether you're anything, right, you see the same kind of normative model that parents are expected to fit into, right? And that's something that I really was surprised by. Because you understand, right, a lot of race problems in schools when whites are on top and minorities are disenfranchised and they're not as academically proficient, right? That's the kind of standard thing we talk about all the time. But even when minorities are actually academically superior to whites in certain schools, even then you're seeing that the effort is made to fit into the kind of a white framework. It's very interesting.
It's a double-edged sword from what you write in terms of some of the particularly Indian American families that you interviewed extensively in the Spelling Bees. They sort of have a very interesting concept of how Native American or, you know, I don't know how best to refer this, but the white families are raising their children. Also is tinged with some interesting racial points of view.
Oh, yeah. No, everyone brings their own racial biases to the conversation. No group can escape that. And so these immigrants I speak to, right, they grew up, a lot of them grew up in Asia, and they come here. And they're professionals. They got really really highly educated in Asia, which is what allows them to come to migrate to the U.S. And they're around and say, you know, we don't want our kids to assimilate into our middle-class neighborhood, even if it's a fine school, because we think, these families around us aren't adequately committed to education. So they really push education on education. And then there's mental health problems with this. That some students reveal. And so that's not like it's a great parenting tactic on its own. But I talk with a lot of parents, right, and they want to know, how much should I push my kids? How much is too much? And my advice to them, based on the research in the book, right, is that we have to listen to what the kids are telling us. If you want your kid to do more than what they're doing academically, for instance, then you should just put them into some kind of program because you've heard about this grade, where they have great advertising. What does your kid show interest in? Double down on that. Find ways of encouraging their growth, intellectual growth, social growth, emotional growth, through what they're expressing to you when they're, you know, when you're at the dinner table with them, or you know, you're tucking them in at sleep. What motivates them? And find ways, creative ways, to nurture their interest while asking them to do a bit more. That's a better approach than just, you know, enrolling kids in Program X or giving them a workbook from you bought online or whatever else, because you're just worried out of a sense of fear that your kid's not learning enough. When parents parent out of a sense of fear, right, it doesn't end up well, because you can never satisfy that fear. Instead, my advice is to parent out of a sense of opportunity. Where do you see your child's interest, and how can you help nurture them?
Exactly. And the peer pressure is also very real in this, in terms of how the kids react, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I spend a lot of time talking with the kids. In the book, I spend a lot of time talking with teachers and principals and other educators, parents, and the kids themselves. And the kids are the ones we should be most concerned about. And they experience a lot of stigma, a lot of pushback. And what's ironic, right, is that some of these are very high-achieving kids. And so the school should be the place where they feel the most comfortable, because they're academically proficient. And in fact, academically
strong. They're stars, yeah.
Yeah, but ironically, school is where they often have to hide their academic ability. So they refer to other, not just other students looking down on their academic success, which is not too surprising, but they even refer to some teachers making them feel bad for being so academically kind of above grade level. And I'm not talking about, you know, the quote, gifted and talented kids. I'm talking about just kids who are just doing well. Okay, I want to make sure that's a distinction. And even they are saying sometimes teachers make them feel ashamed or embarrassed for how much they know. And even, again, not always intentionally by the teachers. So school becomes a place where the youth oftentimes hide and feel stigmatized for their academic achievements, rather than a place where they can brag about them and show them off. And so there's a tension between like what the family's talking about and the family supporting and what's being honored in the school. And that tension, right, can create some stress for kids. So kids are under stress. Sometimes parents do push too hard. Sometimes the school system isn't a good fit. But at the same time, it's the disconnect between what's valued in the school and what's valued in the home that is also part of the problem. Parents would say, I walk into a school, and all I see are the sports trophies, which is fine. You know, that's great. I love sports, right? But if that's not your kid, if that's not what your kid values, then the school is not making the kid feel this is a safe space for them.
Well, and the whole attitude about sports. But one of the things that wasn't in your book that says sort of spoke volumes to me is none of the parents seem to mention that the individual IEP process, the individual educational plan, was a key factor in their children's education in school.
Right. So they,
and of course, that used to be the big tool. I mean, but it's obviously either rusted out or not used, or it has no meaning for many parents and their children.
Right. Really well put. So a lot of them feel that the IEPs are designed, at least best suited, for families whose children need academic support in one way or another. Without it, they would not be able to rise to grade level or maintain grade level. And these are families who then don't see that as pertaining to them today. And so they will, and what's surprising, what you're getting at, what's surprising to me, is how little conversation parents have with teachers about what they want for their kids, and vice versa. How teachers will tell things about the students that I know they never mentioned to the parents of those kids. What we need is more communication between parents and teachers. Parents need to articulate better, teachers, what do they want for their kids educationally, and what is their goal? Well, it's not like it's a given that we all share the same ideas, that teachers know that what parents are looking for. And conversely, teachers need to share with parents what they're seeing in the kids, not just academically, but emotionally. So I had teachers tell me that they see third graders who are so stressed that they're practically nonverbal. right? They don't speak in class. They're just that, they're feeling so pressured. This is great. And parents aren't aware of how their students are experiencing school in this kind of way. And more communication between teachers and parents would create a lot more opportunity and help for the kids.
Ironically, that was supposed to be what the whole IB process was a collaborative process, parents, students, and teachers. But obviously, like I say, it seems not to, from reading between the lines of your book, that's broken. That's not working. We're talking to Professor Pravin Dhingra, who's a professor at Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts, who's written a book called Hypereducation, Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. We've got to ask about the pandemic here. We're talking about hypereducation. And as we were joking when we first started, I mean, hypereducation is almost getting kids out of the house and into a schoolroom. How do you see that integrating with this whole concern about hypereducation? Some of these same families must be just in an uproar thinking that their children can't go to school.
No, I don't think I agree. Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, I have two kids. They're going to, if school reopens for them, like kids across the country, they're going to be the happiest kids ever to go back to school. It's going to be a very strange, unexpected thing. But to your point, right, the COVID moment that we're in and the remote learning has really made a lot of parents worried about how much education their kids are getting. Like education workbooks became best-selling books on Amazon after the pandemic. Because parents are worried, oh, my God, my kids aren't learning enough anymore. And this is not like extreme parents. They're just everyday parents.
Right.
The point is this. This fact that, like, tutoring companies were already some of the fastest-growing companies in the country, and that tutoring was a $200 billion industry already prior to COVID, means that this is just going to grow as more parents are worried that the school is not providing enough learning to them. And tutoring companies are ready to cash in on this moment. They're already putting out ads saying, you know, we, the tutoring companies, can help address the COVID slide and the summer slide that so many youth experience. They have online options. And again, that can be great. I'm not in any way saying that this is a mistake. As I say in the book, we had our own kids in some kind of tutoring space early on, and we pulled them out pretty quickly. But I'm not, so I understand the motivations for this. My point, though, is that this COVID moment is going to make these trends even more pronounced, and that's going to widen the education gap between those who have access and those who don't. And I've written about how Betsy DeVos, for instance, and the Secretary of Education, and her efforts to address this is probably going to make the situation worse. As a result, there are a lot of long-term trends that we're going to see growing because of COVID. And it's going to basically go in the same direction we have now at a faster pace.
Well, you take internet access alone. I mean, New Orleans is a city where some 35% of children don't have access to the internet.
Just telling someone the other day, one in five parents say that their kids can't do education properly because of lack of digital access. But it's not like it's one out of every five kids in the country. Like, there are significant pockets of the country that lack internet access, or at least reliable internet access for their children to do homework, and they are creating real disadvantages for significant pockets of our country. And it's not you know, equally distributed across the country. And so New Orleans, in rural areas as well,
exactly,
the ones that are going to feel the brunt of this.
Well, and libraries where, you know, I mean, I'm around the block, literally, I can walk to my front porch and I look at a library catty corner for me, but it's been closed ever since the pandemic. And, you know, it has 20 computer stations. I mean, that's where I used to see flocks of children in and out, because that's where they got internet access in my neighborhood in the Ninth Ward. So these problems of inequality are just going to really be on steroids now.
Teachers can try to compensate by, and they are, by, you know, hand-delivering homework and doing what all these things are doing to help out the kids. But if you have internet access and then you want to supplement your kid with more education online, you know, some free tutoring or some free, you know, websites, whatever, and you just have more advantages than others will, even if schools and teachers are doing the best they can to compensate for the digital divide.
It's a tough problem. Yeah, I would be remiss not bringing up the spelling bees, which I, you know, frankly, never taken that seriously, and I don't even know if, are they still happening? I guess maybe not this year, but you also dug deeply into some of the experience there.
Right, because if we're thinking about how parents are trying to supplement their kids' education outside of school, there's two main ways. One is through these kind of organized after-school tutoring companies, like I mentioned. Another way is through academic competitions as a way to, like, kind of, you know, beef up your kids' knowledge of a subject. And I put kids in spelling bees and also some math competitions. But the spelling bee is a big cultural phenomenon. You know, it's on ESPN every year. The winner has met the president of the United States. Like, it's a big deal, you know, and kind of for youth. It's very cute. And so to your point, right, it's been canceled this year. Scripps bees have been canceled this year. But I talked to a lot of families who really pursue the spelling bee, a lot of kids who do it. I talked to the there's coaches for spelling bees, believe it or not. You hire out coaches. And like, why do kids like it? Why do some kids tend to do really well in it is also a big part of the book. But what surprised me is I was talking with families who do the spelling bee. They would say, yeah, we want our kids to do well in the spelling bee, but they didn't care about spelling. They just wanted to make sure their kids were getting more academically kind of informed and tutored. And so the families who do it are also the same families who do some kind of other kind of education on the side. But they're wonderful families. I talked to a lot of past champions of Scripps National Spelling Bee and heard their stories about the competition, about the, like, when you're walking up to the microphone to hear your word, that's when you're most fearful. Because you have no idea what it's going to be. And that's when your palms are the sweatiest. And so I have a lot of stories in the book around what it's like to be on stage and such.
So what is all the motivation? Is this to get a better job? Is it more financial security? Time on that, but I don't know if there's really one conclusion, is there?
Well, there's no one thing that motivates every single family per se. So it's going to vary. But, yeah, a lot of families do this for, two main reasons. One, I talk about is the sense of financial security. There's a fear. If I don't give my kids extra academics, if I don't do something for them beyond the school, even if they're in good schools, even if they're doing fine in school and they're very young, then the fear is that the kids will not be able to compete effectively with other kids and get into, you know, a decent university. They don't have to go into Ivy League or something crazy like that, just a decent university and make a life for themselves. It's that kind of fear. The other reason that motivates it at the end of the day is a sense of opportunity. I talked to a lot of parents who said, I don't care what my kids grew up to be in life. I don't care if they become a dog walker, one mother said. I want my daughter, she said, to have confidence and opportunities in life. So the sense that if I don't do something extra beyond the school for my kids, then they will lose out on opportunities later. And so they don't have to be, you know, financially rich. They just need to have, I want them to be able to choose the pathway they want in life. A lot of parents put their kids, like I do, put my kids into sports or the arts or other things after school. That's great, and that's growing, and it's been really popular. But more and more parents are saying, I want something academic after school, not just sports or the arts or civic or religious. And that has become a huge growth market. And so parents are doing this because they want to make sure their kids have some kind of opportunities that they worry, right, as I explained in the book, won't be there otherwise. And it's a new trend.
We've been talking to Professor Pavan Dhingra, who's a professor at Amherst College, and he's written a book called Hypereducation. Professor, how do people get a copy of this book and get deeper into this subject?
Oh, well, it's available wherever books are sold, as they say. So, you know, your major online realtors have it. Your local bookstore can, if they don't have it, they can order it for you. It shouldn't take very long. It's available on an e-reader or obviously the hard copy. And so, yeah, it's available pretty easily.
New York University Press seems to be who put this book out, so it's in hardcover still. And if people want to continue the conversation with you, do you have a website or an email or anything you'd like to offer?
Yeah.
People looking for advice?
I would love to be in communication. So my email is, I'll spell it out, PDHINGRA at Amherst.edu, PDINGRA at Amherst.edu. And my website, it's a lot of letters to spell, but PuffinHDingrich.com.
Exactly.
So easy to find, though.
Well, this is going to be a bridge to cross getting to education in the future. So we'll look forward to the next book as well, because you may have to keep on this subject. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen, you'll never forget. Wade's World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke for Wade's World.